Yemen's Ansarla movement slams as a terrorist policy a U.S. decision to blacklist the group. It says it reserves the right to respond. U.S. officials say 25 domestic terrorism cases have been opened as regards the last week attack on the Capitol by supporters of President Trump. And Palestinians slam as racial discrimination Israel's move to deprive the people in occupied territories of coronavirus vaccines. Hey everyone, welcome to World News here in the Iranian capital. I'm your host, Bahram Sajafi. Good to have you with us. Starting with Yemen, the Ansarla movement has described the U.S. as the source of terrorism after Washington announced the plan to put the group on its terror list. Mohammed Ali Al-Houthi, a member of Yemen's Supreme Political Council, says Ansarla reserves the right to respond to the move. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo says the designation will take effect on the 19th of January. He accused the movement of destabilizing the region and obstructing a peaceful solution to the conflict in Yemen. The Houthis took control of the capital Sana'a and much of Yemen's north in 2014 after the then government resigned. A year later, Saudi Arabia and a number of its allies launched an air campaign to oust the group. The Saudi-led aggression has left tens of thousands of civilians dead. Iran has condemned a U.S. plan to designate Yemen's Ansarla movement as a terror group. Foreign Ministry spokesman Said Khatibzadeh says the move is doomed to fail. It says the blacklisting comes after years of U.S. support for the Saudi-led war in Yemen aimed at toppling the Houthis. It said that those involved in the aggression will soon realize that they will have no choice but to cooperate with groups like Ansarla toward regional stability. Well, I talked to Yemeni activist and political commentator Hussein Al-Bukhaiti a short while ago, and he says that a U.S. decision to blacklist the Ansarla movement won't affect the resistance against Washington-backed Saudi aggression against his country.
It's very clear that this kind of decision actually will not affect the Sana'a government as well, especially will not affect Ansarullah, as they call them, the Houthi, because Yemen has been under blockade for 6 years. Airport and port are closed, and here the forces and the Sana'a army depend on weapons that they have from the previous regime, and as well they have developed many weapons. So this kind of decision actually will only affect Saudi Arabia, because they think this decision will give now a chance for the military wing in Sana'a to take action, because for the last 6 years it was the political wing of the government here in Sana'a who had the upper hand in making decision, and I believe now the time has come for military wing to take action, and they can stop the war by directly targeting Saudi Arabia and targeting United Arab Emirates. And this decision, it just shows that the United States policy in the region and how Trump actually dealing with the effort that has been Martin Griffiths has been trying to do.
U.S. officials say that 25 domestic terrorism cases have been opened regarding last week's attack on Capitol by supporters of President Trump. Those under investigation are suspected of taking part in the insurrection that shut down Congress. A Pentagon official says there is concern that military members may have been involved in the protests. The Pentagon has also asked to review all members who will be part of the security detail for the January 20th inauguration of Joe Biden. Authorities say that's to ensure they aren't sympathetic to domestic terrorists. Five people, including a Capitol officer, were killed after pro-Trump ralliers breached a Capitol building. Meantime, the Justice Department has charged 24 people with regard to the Wednesday incident. Calls for the U.S. president's removal from office are getting louder after the Wednesday storming of the Capitol. Democrats are spearheading an impeachment proposal against the president, blaming him for inciting the siege on the Capitol. 210 lawmakers have become the co-sponsors of the measure. This would make Trump the first U.S. president ever to be impeached twice. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, however, says the lawmakers would first vote on a resolution calling on Vice President Pence to invoke the 25th Amendment. The article allows for a president's immediate unseating if he's deemed unfit to serve. Columnist and political scientist Wilmer Leon says that President Donald Trump should be taken to task for what occurred on the Capitol.
I think the issue is is it right or wrong? And Donald Trump encouraged treason and incited individuals to attack the Capitol. That's wrong. And as President of the United States, he needs to be held accountable for his words that resulted in violent action. And he needs to be held accountable for that. And this is an issue that has been bantered about and discussed in terms of how many members of our police department, how many members of our fire department across the country, fire departments and police departments across the country, are actually directly tied to members of or are sympathetic to organizations of this nature. And that is something that has to be investigated. Individuals have to be identified, and they have to be rooted out if it is determined that they are violent, as in directing their ire against the Constitution.
China has slammed the U.S. decision to remove restrictions on interactions between American and Taiwanese officials. The Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesman Zhao Lijian says that Beijing firmly opposes and strongly condemns the decision. Taiwanese Foreign Minister Joseph Wu said that relations between the U.S. and his country have been elevated to a global partnership. He says Taiwan is seeking to boost the development of the ties further. The U.S. ambassador to the U.N. is due to arrive in Taiwan on Wednesday to visit the president and foreign minister there, and that has fueled Beijing-Washington tensions. China regards Taiwan as one of its provinces and is strongly opposed to increased U.S. support for it. Hakindo Shu, a senior fellow at the Pangol Institution, says that Washington's decision to lift restrictions on contact with Taiwan is another provocative move against Beijing.
This is very provoking. That's why Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesperson called the move as the final madness of this Trump administration. Usually, in the last days of administration like this, they play a role of caretaker, basically taking care of the normal business to make sure there is a power transition. Of course, there's big trouble in the U.S. The regime is in its final days, and Pompeo's days are numbered at the Secretary of State. He is making such a move. I think he's creating a trouble for the incoming administration led by Biden. So that will make Biden in a very kind of dilemma. If they want to roll back, they will face criticism for so-called being soft to Beijing. If they don't do, that will create a trouble in their relationship with Beijing. And in terms of China-U.S. relations, we know that Trump and Pompeo, in particular Pompeo, I would say, in last year, he has been pushing hard for a second version of a Cold War against the rise of China. He's sort of like a desperate, trying to sabotage the relationship between the two countries. Taiwan is one of the cards he has used against Beijing, along with Xinjiang, Hong Kong, Tibet, etc.
Time now for the news review section. Stay with us. Palestinians have denounced Israel for ignoring responsibility to ensure the availability of COVID vaccines to the people in the occupied territories. In a statement, the Palestinian Foreign Ministry says that Israel has committed racial discrimination by depriving the Palestinians of their right to health care. It says the attempt by the Palestinian leadership to secure the vaccines from various sources doesn't exempt Tel Aviv from its duties as an occupying power. The regime is facing growing criticism since it began a vaccination drive mandating officials to exclude Palestinians in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. The Palestinian Authority saying it expects the first COVID vaccine doses in March under a deal with British drug maker AstraZeneca. A top Palestinian health official saying that other pharmaceuticals have also been contacted for supplies. Time now to get some insight on this. We'll first go to our correspondent, Ramallah Mona Kandil. We'll also have Mazin Konzi, a Palestinian scientist and author, joining us out of Bethlehem. Now let's go to Mona. I know that Palestinians in occupied territories are facing a plethora of different kinds of restrictions, especially those in the Gaza Strip are under this crippling siege for long years. And now on top of that comes the COVID pandemic. Tell us a bit more about what the situation is like there and how difficult it could be to get their hands on vaccines from elsewhere.
It's very difficult because Palestinians and the occupied West Bank, let's speak about the occupied West Bank and Jerusalem, Al-Quds, it's under Israeli occupation. At the same time, the Gaza Strip is completely besieged. So these vaccines, if they are allowed to enter the Palestinian territories, they should be approved by the Israelis. That's why the Palestinian Authority accused Israel of ignoring its responsibilities to ensure vaccines that should be available in the occupied territories. Today we are speaking about Israel that has already become the world leader in vaccinations per capita. Palestinians in the occupied West Bank and the Gaza Strip still will be facing a lot of difficulties and need to secure their first supplies. Israel is occupying the Palestinian territories, so it has, according to the Palestinians and according to the international laws, it has a responsibility to ensure the vaccines. But let's not to forget that at the first of the spread of the COVID-19, Israel closed a number of clinics in Jerusalem Al-Quds and in a number of areas that serve the Palestinians in order not to allow Palestinians test for the corona virus. At that time, it was condemned globally. So it's not, they don't care if the Palestinians receive the vaccines or not.
Now, let me ask Mazin Gamsia, the Palestinian scientist and author in Bethlehem. Mazin, it's the Tel Aviv regime's job to provide to and facilitate the Palestinians' access to COVID vaccines. Isn't it his job? So why is it shirking responsibility? How can it?
Well, what we have here is an apartheid regime, and there's apartheid also in medicine. You know, there's an international convention on the crime of apartheid and racial discrimination, which specifically says that people living in the same country should not be subjected to two different sets of laws, and that's how it defines apartheid. And we have two different sets of privileges and laws that apply to Israelis and ones that apply to Palestinians. For example, Israelis living here in Bethlehem or in Ramallah, in a settlement next to the Palestinian community, the Israeli settlers, colonial settlers, who are illegal per international law, they get their vaccinations, whereas the Palestinian residents and native people, indigenous people of this land, don't have vaccinations. This is medical apartheid, and there's nothing, you know, in international law, it's very, very clear what it is. And so what we Palestinians have called for is ending the regime of apartheid, which affects all these spheres, including the medical spheres, the vaccinations, availability of medicines, the destruction of our economy that result in the fact that hospitals are not coping with the number of patients. In Gaza especially, I mean, it's bad in the West Bank, but in Gaza it's even worse because the hospitals are overwhelmed. People are literally being left to die at home because there's no space in the hospitals for them.
And Mazin, is there any international organization or agency trying to do something and to kind of provide vaccines for the Palestinians, or Palestinians should rely on their own very limited resources to do that?
Well, the World Health Organization is working with the Palestinian health officials to try and facilitate transfer of vaccines. A big segment of this is also cost of vaccines. Who's going to pay for them? Israel has, is a very rich country, gets billions of dollars from the United States to the tune of $15 million a day, actually. And so they have a lot of resources to buy vaccines. We, being under occupation, are not, is not a poor country. We're not a poor country like countries that don't have much natural resources. We have been a rich country, but we were intentionally impoverished, intentionally de-developed, because Israel wants to drive us out. And this is part of the reason why we don't have the economic wherewithals, the resources to pay for vaccines, and basically compete with the rich countries. There's also around the world, I mean, it's not just here, you have an issue with rich countries getting vaccines and poor or developing enough vaccines, and even sometimes within the same country, like Saudi Arabia, the royal family is getting the vaccines, but the rest of the poor Saudis who are barefooted in the desert, they don't have vaccines.
Unfortunately. Thank you very much for your comments. Mazen Gomsi, a Palestinian scientist and author from Bethlehem.
Thank you.
We also had Timona Kandil, our correspondent, who joined us from Ramallah. Now, the global number of confirmed COVID-19 cases has surpassed the grim milestone of 19 million. This, as a new variant of the virus, is rapidly spreading across the world. Figures released by Johns Hopkins University show the global death toll is now at 1.9 million. The U.S., India, and Brazil remain the hardest hit countries by the novel coronavirus in terms of infection. The U.S. has registered 22.4 million cases and 375,000 deaths. Several European countries are struggling with a new highly infectious coronavirus strain. The seriousness of the situation caused many European states to implement further movement restrictions. Now let's take a look at Brazil. Weekly moving average of fatalities per day has surpassed 1,000 for the first time since early August. And that's happening while COVID-19 cases continue to surge in the South American nation. That's the world's second worst hit country in terms of deaths. The Brazilian Health Ministry registered nearly 30,000 new cases on Sunday, raising the total number of infections to 8.1 million. Authorities also reported 470 additional COVID fatalities, pushing the death toll to more than 203,000. And that's happening amid growing pressure on President Jair Bolsonaro to speed up the vaccine rollout. Bolsonaro has come under harsh criticism not only for his government's mishandling of the pandemic, but also for an inability to correctly distribute and administer sufficient doses of the vaccine. That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is John. Welcome back to another episode of our weekly show, The Subcontinent. Our program aims to address important issues in the subcontinent which affect the governments, people, organizations, and the region as a whole. We will try to explain the issues, break down controversies surrounding them, and try to have some external perspectives from experts and people.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we will take a look at the major events and news that took place throughout the year across the countries of this vast region.
This year was marred by the COVID pandemic, and the uncertainty it ensued was not only in the subcontinent, but for the entire world. The normal flow of life was disrupted by the COVID pandemic in almost all the societies, and the economic prospects are grim for the whole subcontinent. Wide-ranging lockdowns took great tolls on social and economic status of many people and industries, resulting in unemployment and unwanted migration, as well as nationwide protests.
The year 2020 will be remembered in future history books as the year that one of humanity's smallest enemies hit the entire planet with a shadow of doubt about the future. It impacted the political and social discourse everywhere, and the subcontinent was no exception. The first cases of the coronavirus were reported in the winter of 2020 in most of the countries, and in less than 2 or 3 months, almost all of the subcontinent started enforcing on and off nationwide lockdowns. Uncertainty about the future of the outbreak or possible lockdowns resulted in the bankruptcy and closure of numerous businesses, and consequently the unemployment of workers that caused even more financial insecurity for the people. India, for instance, witnessed a colossal migration of workers from cities to their home villages as there were not enough jobs in the cities anymore. As one of the key sources of revenue for most of the subcontinental nations such as Nepal, Maldives or Bhutan, the tourism industry was among the most disastrously hit due to the COVID-19 restrictions.
The World Bank predicts in a report that South Asia's economic outlook is grim as the region is set to plunge into its worst ever recession as the devastating impacts of COVID-19 on South Asian economies linger on. As per the norm of the world, such impacts are disproportionately costly for the ordinary workers as millions of South Asians are pushed into extreme poverty.
India's economy, the region's largest, is expected to contract by 9.6% in the fiscal year that started in March 2020. Regional growth is projected to rebound to 4.5% in 2021. Factoring in the population growth, however, income per capita in the region will remain 6% below 2019 estimates, indicating that the expected rebound will not offset the lasting economic damage caused by the pandemic. The government of Premier Narendra Modi, that was struggling economically even before the outbreak, used the downward trends as a cover to go ahead with its nationwide plan to privatize many industries and implement a wide array of reforms. His initiatives were greeted by nationwide demonstrations as different sectors were protesting for different reasons. Protests against the changes in the agriculture sector are still being held by farmers throughout the country.
Today we are organizing rallies in support of the bond. Here in Calcutta we have also organized. Now we have burnt an effigy of the King of India, Modi.
In late November, a mass general strike was held across India. The strike was organized by 10 trade unions across the country and was supported by the Indian National Congress, the Marxist Communist Party of India, and some other left-wing parties. The strike saw an estimated 250 million people involved, making it the largest in history.
Not only didn't the daily battle against the disease make the tyrants feel less sympathy for their fellow humans, but also the loud global frenzy caused by the pandemic rendered the oppressed even more voiceless, as the news of their daily ordeal were less heard or even noticed. The government of Narendra Modi, which has been facing protests and riots since the introduction of the citizenship law that discriminates against Muslims, even used this opportunity to further suppress the Muslims in the entire country by arresting many high-profile Muslim activists and ordinary civilians under the cover of the coronavirus pandemic.
The suffering of Muslim minorities across the subcontinent have always been among the most underreported issues, but in 2020, stories of their ordeal were further buried under the pile of daily coverage and updates about the pandemic. In Bangladesh, the woes of Rohingyas never abate as they are deprived from the basic human rights. In February, 15 Rohingya refugees died, while another 72 were rescued when a trawler bound for Malaysia sank near St. Martin's Island in the Bay of Bengal.
Unfortunately, we are seeing the situation in Myanmar vis-a-vis Rohingyas is continuing. I mean, they are identified as the most oppressed and most persecuted community. And this is continuing, and unfortunately it's continuing because there is no political will to address this. West and the international community are they've got no political will, and this is really continuing, is becoming worse, not just inside Myanmar, but those who managed to escape the death and the torture and rape. And they are actually living in a very difficult circumstances in Bangladesh and India and elsewhere. And what is really important to recognize is that the fact that there is no political will to address this issue, it's given green light to others to go down the same route.
In September, 24 more people died after a leak in a gas pipeline caused an explosion in a mosque in Narayanganj district. In bloodier waves of attacks against Muslims, Hindu mobs killed or brutalized scores of Muslims in northeast Delhi in late February. Of the 53 people killed in the bout of violence, two-thirds were Muslims who were shot, slashed with repeated blows, or set on fire. The number of such attacks has increased since the Hindu nationalist government is in power.
We are seeing vis-a-vis what is happening in India. Muslims in India are now prosecuted, and there has been the rise of extremism and empowerment of extremism because of their connection to the Indian government. And the fact that they are getting away with murder and lynching of the Muslims. And also, we've got the situation of Kashmir. Matters are becoming much worse. I think the international community needs to respond. And the lack of response by international community to address these injustices actually leading to the circumstances that the matter is getting worse. And unfortunately, I don't see any light at the end of the tunnel. And unfortunately, I don't see even the Muslims around the world and the OIC and others really responding adequately to this very blatant Islamophobia, and the fact that Muslims seem to be a community that could be abused and oppressed across the world, and in particular in that region. And no one is going to be held accountable.
Just as the riots were ongoing in Delhi, Premier Modi hosted US President Donald Trump in such a welcoming ceremony that it was unbelievable for the lame duck president. The Namaste Trump tour event held in Ahmedabad as a response to the Howdy Modi event in Texas served as a platform for the US president and the Indian Prime Minister to display their friendship and show off a $3 billion military deal.
2020 was shockingly abysmal for many people across the entire planet, but blood and tears are such frequent occurrences in some parts of the subcontinent that nothing can halt or dwindle them, not even in the face of a shared biological enemy. As Amphan and Nisarga cyclones and swarms of locusts kept ravaging large swaths of land across the virus-hit subcontinent, some human-induced hazards, like gas leaks and pipeline explosions, added to the misery of the people on the backdrop of border clashes and terrorist attacks. The most important rivalries of the subcontinent come down to the dynamics of ties between India, Pakistan, and China. And in the year 2020, the heights of Himalayas witnessed a dizzying array of military movements and confrontations as India was engaged in skirmishes with both Pakistan and China. During an aggressive melee between India and China in May, several Indian and Chinese soldiers were at the Nathula crossing and other locations across the Sino-Indian border, including near the disputed Pangong Lake in Ladakh and the Tibet Autonomous Region, and near the border between Sikkim and the Tibet Autonomous Region. Moreover, India and Pakistan escalated their adversary to new levels over Kashmir. More than 15 people were killed along the line of control in their face-offs that are increasingly getting fierier, especially after India's change in the country's constitution on the status of the region. Territorial disputes over the Kashmir region sparked two of the three major Indo-Pakistani wars in 1947 and 1965, and a limited war in 1999. Although both countries have maintained a fragile ceasefire since 2003, they regularly exchange fire across the contested border known as the line of control. Both sides accuse the other of violating the ceasefire and claim to be shooting in response to attacks. An uptick to border skirmishes that began in late 2016 and continued into 2018 killed dozens and displaced thousands of civilians on both sides of the line of control. This year has been particularly violent. The June clash in the Galwan Valley, fought with sticks and clubs, not guns, was the first fatal confrontation between the two sides since 1975, and relations have continued to deteriorate. India acknowledged its deaths. China did not comment on reports it also suffered fatalities. If neither side gives way, the standoff could have destabilizing consequences for the region. If they come to blows again, there is a risk of escalation between the world's most populous countries, both established nuclear powers. Usually, the locust swarms enter India through Pakistan for summer breeding in June or July with the advent of the monsoon. But this year, Indian officials say the pink swarm started much earlier in April because of presence of residual population in Pakistan that couldn't be controlled last season. Pink immature adults fly high and cover long distances during daytime hours before settling on trees at night. They are very active and their mobility makes it difficult to control individual swarms.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
Now, for more analysis on the current situation and future prospects in India, we are joined by Mr. Sanjay Jha, who is an Indian politician, an ex-banker, and the author of the recently published book, The Great Unraveling, India After 2014. Mr. Jha, welcome back to the show. So, for many countries around the world, 2020 would be remembered as a year of health tragedy and economic downfall. How has India been in this situation, and how do you see the handling of this situation?
Well, India has had an equally difficult period. We are a country that battled a very severe pandemic, much against the earlier expectations. And as you're aware, that after America, India has had the highest number of cases of infections of coronavirus. It has been, a challenge because of our weak public health infrastructure. And the fact that, in the urban cities of India, there's high density of population. So large sections of people were affected very, very negatively. While there has been a significant improvement over the last couple of weeks, we are still, I would say, at this point of time, in the process of trying to overcome what has been a very formidable challenge. Fortunately, I do believe that at the end of the day, the people of India, the society, have risen collectively together to exercise better discipline. We could have done better, but one cannot deny that there has been good public consciousness. And I would say that the central government and the state governments have at least taken it in a very, very serious intent. And to that extent, at least I'm optimistic that going forward, India should be able to contain the virus in the coming weeks, especially now that the vaccine is down the corner.
India has gone through a severe pandemic indeed, and as you said, things might improve. So some of the government's nationwide plans for privatization were greeted by nationwide demonstrations and protests, the latest one being by the farmers. Why is it like this?
Well, the fact is that the coronavirus pandemic resulted in a massive contraction of India's GDP by 23% in the first quarter, which was perhaps the worst in the entire universe. It has come down since, but we are still battling a serious economic recession. There are protests by the farmers who are very upset with the new laws. There is a lot of backlash even against labor reforms. And the reason behind that is very straightforward. India has still 22% of people living below the poverty line. That works out to almost over 300 million people. And the pandemic has worsened inequality. There has been a concentration of financial and economic resources in the hands of a few, especially the big tech companies and large, too big to fail companies. So India is actually seeing a major backlash from those who live, as they say, at the borderline. And the farmers' protest is a manifestation of a very serious crisis of inequality, poverty, and a social inequity in our system.
Mr. Jha, before continuing, let's just take a quick look at how the global media has covered the situation.
Migrant flight has serious implications on the already fragile rural health infrastructure. It is estimated that between 2 million and 10 million migrants were impacted by COVID-19. A severe impact on other health programs due to COVID-19 is also evident from the analysis of the National Health Mission data on inpatient and outpatient treatment. Between 100,000 and 200,000 children missed routine vaccinations during February and March. Treatment for tuberculosis also showed declines. Despite the rapidly rising numbers, India has reopened gyms, most workplaces and markets. Given that India has administered only 60 million tests so far, the majority of its population may yet contract the virus. But New Delhi's approach seems to prioritize protecting livelihoods, a choice perhaps influenced by the release earlier this month of quarterly data showing a 24% contraction of India's economy. Other South Asian countries seem to be faring better than India. Afghanistan, Bangladesh and Pakistan, countries whose median ages are 10, 2 and 4 years lower than that of India, respectively, have dramatically slowed the spread of the coronavirus and recorded a low number of new deaths. India is 4 times larger in area, 7 times in population and 10 times in GDP than Pakistan. Yet in the dismal realm of COVID-19, bigger numbers are nothing to boast of. Whereas, India's burden is still rising by 70,000 new cases a day. Pakistan's caseload seems to have peaked 3 months ago. Its daily total of new cases has remained in the mere hundreds since early August. India's economy has also fared far worse. The Asian Development Bank predicts that its GDP will shrink by fully 9% in the current fiscal year, compared with a contraction of 0.4% for Pakistan.
All right, welcome back, Mr. Jha, and thank you to the audience as well for staying with us. So, Mr. Jha, you said that the backlash is coming from the most affected people in terms of equality and in terms of poverty. How long do you think it would take for India to recover from the impacts of the pandemic?
Technically, there are people who believe that we should be able to hit around 0% growth rate in the quarter of January to March of 2021. people are very optimistic that India may even have a V curve in some sectors where recovery is concerned. But if you look at India structurally, in terms of the informal sector, where data is very hard to capture, or the rural sector, the agricultural, shall we say, sector, these are areas where it's not easy to capture the real ground level crisis that we face. For example, the migrant crisis, which became a humanitarian problem. The record unemployment that you cannot really write off at all, it's got progressively worse. Manrega demands have gone up because there has been a reverse migration. A lot of the SME companies, which were anyway struggling, are finding it very difficult. And please do not forget that India was already struggling on the economy front at a growth rate of around 3 to 3.5% even before the pandemic. So you have seen an aggravation of India's economic woes. Technically, I do believe India might see a GDP growth rate of around 10 to 12% as a bounce back on a lower database. But it would take at least 2 years, in my opinion, for India to begin to get the confidence that we are back in business.
All right. Thank you so much, Mr. Jha, for coming to our show again. It was nice having you here.
Thank you very much indeed. Thank you very much for inviting me.
Let's see how people on social media see the events that passed 2020.
In the midst of the coronavirus pandemic, Prime Minister Imran Khan, by tweeting this tweet, mentioned the tough choice of the governments of the region in imposing lockdown or not doing so in order to save their economy. Rahul Mukherjee also refers to many poor people and workers who have suffered a lot due to the lockdown and the pandemic. Regarding the November general strike, Rizwan Rahman, as a protester, marks the ruler's brutal and inhuman treatment to workers as the main reason of the protests. And also about the issue of the minority rights, Rami refers to the important issues such as Islamophobia, the Kashmir conflict, caste atrocities, and the daily violence, and considers injustice as an unchanged, deep-rooted problem. And at last, Mary Thomas opines the tensions between Muslims and Hindus are actually due more to political factors rather than the religious ones.
And that was our episode about the events that took place throughout the year across the subcontinent. We'll meet next week.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EM.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except him, and he has enjoined kindness to parents.
The first type of right that Imam Sajjad alayhi salam speaks about in his treatise is the right of God, the right of Allah, Haqqullah.
For Humanity, a commentary on Risalatul Huquq of Imam Sajjad alayhi salam.
By Hujjatul Islam, Zayd al-Salam.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. Wa salatu wassalamu ala Sayyidina Muhammad wa alihi al-Tahirin. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, dear listeners, and welcome to IRIB English Radio and our program For Humanity, where we are discussing Risalatul Huquq, the treaties of rights of Imam As-Sajjad, peace be upon him. And in this particular haqq, which is haqq number 37, haqqul khaliyat, the rights of the associate or those who you associate with, Imam As-Sajjad, peace be upon him, tries to highlight certain things that we need to be very, very observant of. And that is the first thing that Imam As-Sajjad, peace be upon him, says, وَأَمَّا حَقُّ الْخَلِيطَ فَأَنْ لَا تَغُرَّهُ وَلَا تَغُشَّهُ. And as for the rights of your associate, that you do not trick them and that you do not deceive them. Continuing on with what we were speaking about in the previous session, giving an outlook on how necessary it is for us to be very, very selective when it comes to our associates. You know, there's a few traditions that speak about, you know, if you are so observant of what comes into your stomach, why are you not observant of, or equally observant or more observant of, the knowledge and who gives you the knowledge? Why are you not observant of the type of people and the quality of people that mix around you? We even have cases in the history of our imams, peace be upon them, where people have asked, why did Imam, for example, Imam Sadiq's elder son, you know, deviate away from the path and whatnot? And the answer to this is because of their associates. And again, this is not something only related to this religion or that religion. It's something that all of us as a collective society around the world needs to be cautious of, for ourselves and also for our children. It isn't just entertainment, but more of being responsible for who it is that you're mixing with. You know, you want to have fun. You are entitled to have some entertainment and some time off. You need to socialize, but be responsible. Be cautious of who these individuals or who this individual is. You don't want to mix with someone who is dubious, or else no one will be blamed except for yourself. Sometimes you find someone who, in principle, does not have and does not share the same values as you. What are you going to benefit from them? How are you going to be able to influence them in a positive way? Or what do you see yourself to be influenced by them in the positive way, especially when you are going to be in their presence and you will absorb that kind of atmosphere and environment? And in most cases, if not in all cases, they will weaken the foundation that you have. Just going to go for a short break and we will be back soon.
Dear listeners, you're listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Just before the break, we were speaking about you and I and everyone around us needing to be more careful about who we socialize with. And if you're not careful, then this person who might not have the same values as you might weaken the foundation that you have, might trigger in your mind dangerous misconceptions that are completely baseless as well. But yet, because of your vulnerability, because maybe of your emotional attachment to that person, you know, this is what happens. And therefore, your morals and your views and your behavior and your conduct will all be changing. And we're not only talking about your ideological views, we're also talking about your conduct and your behavior. There might be cases where, you know, you get to know somebody and they might, you know, want to introduce you to bad things. You know, well, it's only one puff, it's only a smoke, it's only us damaging public property, it's only, you know, mixing with this kind of person. Yes, he only has a small criminal record, and then one thing drags onto another thing, and then another thing, and unfortunately, this goes down the wrong way. And this reminds me of a nice piece of poetry that has been said in Arabic, الرِّيحُ أَخِذُ مِمَّا تَمُرُّ بِهِ, that wind takes up whatever it goes over. نَتِنًا مِنَ الْنَتِنِ أَوْ طِيب مِنَ الْطِيب, whether it be a stinky smell, the wind absorbs that stinky smell, or whether it be a pleasant scent, that wind absorbs the pleasant scents. Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa alihi, he has said, مَثَلُ الْجَلِيسُ الصَّالِحِ مِثَلُ الْعَطَّارِ, the likes of a good company, because you can say خَلِيط, you can say Nadim, you can say Jalis, all of them have in Arabic have the same meaning, and that is those who you are in company with, those who are your accomplices, those who are your associates, those who are your friends, those who you mix with. مثل الجليس الصالح مثل العطار, is like a perfume seller, a perfume merchant. إن لم يصبك من عطره أصبت من ريحه, if you are not fortunate to get any perfume from him, you will absorb the scent that comes from this عطار, this perfume merchant. ومثل الجليس السوء, and as for an evil, a bad associate, مثل القيران, إن لم يحترق ثوبك أصابك من ريحه, it's like the likes of tar, that if that tar doesn't burn your clothing, you are going to be inflicted by its scent and its bad odor. A lot more needs to be said about this. We will continue on in speaking about Imam As-Sajjad's segment here on Haqqul Khaliyat in our next program, The Right of an Associate. And until then, please visit us on parstoday.com, or alternatively, you're able to email us on englishradio@irib.ir. And until then, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
صلي يا ربي على طه الأمين رحمة أرسلته للعالمين وعلى آل النبي أجمعين فبهم نرجوك أحسن ختمنا
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.